Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week, Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers, so let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take another look at Ted Bundy. Before we get into it this week, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast True Crime. If you'd like to help support the show, you can go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, Ted Bundy had just been charged with the Chi Omega murders, as well as a separate case where he's charged with the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. And I talked in pretty horrific detail about what was discovered with Kimberly Leach as far as the manner of her death. And this week we're going to get through the trials of Bundy. Now, even before he goes to trial for either of these cases, Ted is becoming something of a nuisance for his jailers, making numerous requests, going out of his way to thumb his nose at the judicial system, even as he is playing it up for the media. And obviously, this is going to enrage the authorities in Florida, but there's not much that they can do about it. And Ted is taking the attacks, you know, of what he sees character assassination personally, and to those who will listen to him, he's claiming that all of the evidence is fabricated and that he had nothing to do with any of these crimes. And this is a stance that he is going to maintain off and on for the remainder of his life. One bone of contention that Ted rightfully had was with Dr. Richard Soveron, who was the forensic orthodontist who claimed that he could match the bite marks in the Chi Omega victims to Ted Bundy's teeth. And the reason that Bundy took such great issue with this individual is the fact that well prior to the start of any of the trials, this dentist was at a conference for other forensic orthodontists, and he made mention of the Bundy case showing slides of the teeth as well as the bite marks, and stating that he was able to prove Bundy's guilt using these. Why is this a problem? Well, beyond the fact that, as I've already discussed, forensic orthodontics is a pseudoscience, Bundy had not yet been convicted on any of the counts against him. So for this doctor to go before a group of his peers and publicly claim this, really, if the courts had been, you know, working correctly and had not had been swayed by any form of public pressure, that piece of evidence should have been thrown out just because of the doctor's actions. And I really have to believe that were this case tried today, with all of the things that we know, the advances in technology, they more likely than not would have been able to find some other form of evidence for to prove Bundy's guilt, but also that this piece of evidence, which is really what the prosecution's case is going to hinge upon, would have been disallowed. Pre-trial hearings officially began in May of 1979 for the Chi Omega crimes, with Bundy effectively acting as lead counsel and a team of public defenders acting as his co-counsel. It's known that on May 31st, Bundy filed a secret motion with the judge, and many believe that this motion was in fact a guilty plea for Ted to avoid the death penalty and plead guilty to lesser charges of second-degree murder, which would, of course, mean that Bundy may at some point have been eligible for parole. However, Bundy decides to refuse this, thus paving the way for a trial, but also for the state to, in fact, seek the death penalty. One thing that came out of all the pretrial maneuverings is that Nita Neary, the woman who had seen the intruder in the Chi Omega house, picks Bundy out in the courtroom. And why is this a problem? The individual she stated she saw was wearing a toboggan on his head, so the majority of his face was not able to be seen. But also because her description of the assailant did not match Ted Bundy at all. And again, my own personal opinion, I believe that this eyewitness identification should have been disallowed based solely on the fact that her witness ID initially did not resemble Ted Bundy or the description. And that allowing this showed the possibility that she had been coerced into identifying Bundy by members of law enforcement, which was an assertion that Bundy long held, and which is, you know, on solid legal footing. It's not like she saw his entire face. She saw him in the dark from a peripheral view of the side, wearing this mask with no real discernible features visible, and those that were able to be seen not matching up to Ted Bundy. If you'll recall, her initial thought was that the man responsible was the houseboy, who did indeed have a large nose. However, Bundy was able to get any mention of the Utah trials, specifically the pantyhose mask that was found, disbarred from the courtroom, as the judge felt that it was too far removed from the crime at hand. Also suppressed were the tapes made when Bundy was arrested in Pensacola, as well as the officer's testimony concerning statements Bundy is claimed to have made after the tape recorder was turned off. So whatever Bundy supporters may want to say, the judge was even-handed in his allowals and dismissals for both sides on this case, with opening statements being given by both the prosecution and the defense, despite Bundy's attempts to have the case pushed back to start on Monday. And you really look at this case, it's one of the few that I can think of where both opening statements are given on the opening day of court. I mean, we look back at the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Both the defense and the prosecution spent multiple days in their opening statements, but here, in 1979, with Ted Bundy on trial and suspected of being a serial killer, both sides are able to get what needs to be said to the jury done rather quickly. And the trial itself did not last an inordinate amount of time. Despite all the buildup from the local press, it was a fairly low-key trial, with few things of note other than the fact that at the very end, Bundy tried to get the judge to allow him to subpoena media outlets for pictures of him. This was because Bundy claimed he had actually chipped his tooth after his arrest, and that in fact the teeth marks on the victims at the Chi Omega house could not have been left by him because of this, as there was an obvious gap in between two of the teeth. The judge did not allow this. And on July 23rd, 1979, after giving them their instructions, the judge sent the jury off to deliberate. At just about 9:15 that evening, the jury reached out to the judge to inform them that they had reached a verdict. And on that night in the courtroom, Ted Bundy was found guilty of all crimes for which he was accused. On July 28th at 10 a.m., the penalty phase of Bundy's trial, numerous witnesses from the Durantia case, as well as from Colorado, take the stand, and unsurprisingly, Ted is sentenced to death. After delivering the sentence, the judge informs Bundy basically that he's sorry that Ted had taken the path in life that he has. There is no animosity from him towards Bundy, and that he felt that if Bundy had chosen a different path, he would have been a fantastic lawyer. Now, there's been a lot of speculation as to why Ted Bundy went to Florida when he could have gone anywhere in the country following his escape from Colorado. My contention has always been that Ted Bundy knew on some level that what he was doing was wrong, and he hated the fact that he did these things but was unable to control that compulsion. And I believe that subconsciously he went to Florida with the intention of committing these murders, knowing that he was going to be found out eventually, and that not only was he going to be found out, that he was going to be sentenced to death, and that death would be the only release that he would know from the thoughts and compulsions that he, in fact, suffered from. And that is a suffering. Many who knew Ted Bundy, even after his convictions and after his death, had a hard time joining the two images of the man that they knew versus the man who had been convicted in court together. And I've always felt that Bundy was one of the few serial killers who understood what he was and that he could not stop and chose to commit further crimes in a state that was known to execute those found guilty of murder because he wanted to escape. That isn't to say that Bundy is not going to fight the convictions or that he is not going to do everything that he is capable of doing to forestall the inevitable, but that part of him wanted to die because he did not fully want to do these things and wanted to, again, escape the thing that was inside of him that led him to commit these heinous acts. The trial for the murder of Kimberly Leach began on July 7th, 1980. And it was said that Bundy was really much changed from his time in prison, that it had worn on him. He still attempted to affect the defense that he had while during the first trial, but it was noted that he looked worn out, much older than he was, and at times would throw temper tantrums. There's a very famous picture of Bundy screaming from this trial in black and white, and commentators have stated that this is the only known video evidence of the real Ted Bundy, the monster that his victims saw when he would take their lives. Much as with the first trial, Bundy is found guilty and is again sentenced to death. And he is going to spend a considerable amount of time trying to avoid being executed over the next decade. Bundy, on the one hand, is professing his innocence. On the other hand, to those who he wants something from, specifically members of the FBI and of the media, Bundy is going to go on and present himself as the expert on serial killers, which during this period of time is a very new concept that most people in the general public and indeed in law enforcement are not familiar with. And Ted is going to try and parlay this expertise into avoiding the death penalty and becoming important enough to law enforcement for his knowledge that they will in fact keep him. One of the ways that Bundy did this was by making himself available to different law enforcement agencies, although a lot of the things that he said to these agencies have never been made public. We do know that he attempted to offer his aid to the Washington authorities as they attempted to track down Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. We know that they accepted this. In fact, there was a book and movie made on this fact. This is really a double-edged sword because some people wonder why Bundy would do this. I've always thought that it was because of his ego. He did not want to see another Washington serial killer surpass the number of victims that he himself had claimed. Whether or not Ridgway actually did, unfortunately, we will never really know. Bundy is known to have killed somewhere between 30 and 37 victims, although if you believe officers from Pensacola, that number may be higher, as Bundy is purported to have said to them, add one digit to it and you'll have it. Many in law enforcement who had dealings with Ted Bundy believed that he had killed in excess of 100 women, and that this is very probably true. I have always wondered about that myself. Bundy was very secretive, and there are periods of his life where his whereabouts cannot, in fact, be, you know, concretely documented. When it's known that young women did in fact go missing and or turned up dead. And so at this point, before we get to Bundy's actual execution, we are going to briefly look at some of the cases that Ted Bundy is suspected of. The first of these is 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr, who disappeared in Tacoma, Washington in 1961 when Bundy was 14 years old. And law enforcement is divided on Bundy's involvement in this particular case. One individual in the FBI said that the Burr case represented what Bundy had said were the things he would never talk about, cases that were too close to home, too close to family, and too young, which indicates that the FBI at least believes that Bundy is probably responsible for this crime. Again, we'll never know because Bundy was executed. We do know that even up until his dying day, he stated that he was not, in fact, responsible for this case. Basically, what happened was Anne Marie's family went to bed. They woke up, or Anne Marie woke up in the middle of the night because something was wrong with her sister. Her parents took care of it. Her sister woke up again during the night, and her family found that she was missing. There was an open window in the downstairs of the house, and Anne Marie was never seen again. I want to make this clear. A lot of stories have come out about Bundy, particularly from his childhood. I don't believe most of them, particularly those who talk about Bundy luring young children into the woods and having harmed children, stabbing some of them. And the reason I don't believe this is the majority of the people who made these claims made them well after the fact, after, in many cases, Bundy had been executed. And I think that those particular individuals were simply seeking their 15 minutes of fame by claiming to have known this individual, grown up with them, and they have juicy information about him that, you know, is going to earn them a small payday. The next crime was the assault of Lisa Wick and Lonnie Ann Trumbull, two 20-year-old flight attendants who were bludgeoned inside of their Seattle apartment in 1966. Now, this case does have the hallmarks of other crimes that we know Ted Bundy committed, including the assaults in that area in the early part of the 1970s where the victim survived, as well as the Chi Omega murders. Lisa Wick, who survived, did later state that she firmly believes that Ted Bundy is responsible for this attack. We know that Bundy was in fact in the area when this attack occurred. There's also a case from 1969 in New Jersey where two vacationing women from Pennsylvania were stabbed to death. I don't believe that Bundy was responsible for this particular crime because it does not fit any of the hallmarks of the crimes that we know that he committed, and therefore, personally, I have to check this particular case off of the list of what Bundy may or may not have done. The next case is that of Carrie Mae Hardy, who disappeared from the Woodland Park area of Seattle in 1972, with her remains being discovered roughly 5 miles from the Taylor Mountain burial site in 2010. No cause of death is available for her, although law enforcement does consider Bundy a suspect in this crime. Bundy is known to have confessed to law enforcement of murders that took place in the state of Oregon, although he refused to identify them. Law enforcement subsequently pegged 3 murders from Bundy's known active time period as being ones that he may have, in fact, been responsible for. Those are the main cases I wanted to look at. There are some others, but their connections to Bundy are tenuous at best. And unfortunately, some of the cases that are still being connected to Bundy have in fact been found to have been committed by other individuals, such as the murder of Catherine Lee Devine. Now we're going to move on to the end period with Bundy. He was scheduled to die numerous times. However, each time, Bundy was able to get a stay of execution. This all ran out in 1989. On January 24th, 42-year-old Theodore Robert Bundy was executed in the state electric chair. Now, in the days preceding Bundy's execution, he really scrambled to try and prove to law enforcement that they should intervene to get his execution sustained by confessing to his various crimes. It's known that he confessed 2 murders in Idaho, although for both of these victims, he said that he threw their bodies into what he believed was the Snake River. Some of the information he gave, particularly in conjunction with the Ted murders that took place in Washington, the officer who interviewed him has refused to give out that information as it was simply too disturbing. And it's very likely that to this officer, Bundy told of additional murders that just for whatever reason, the officer has decided not to divulge. Unfortunately, despite the fact that Bundy became willing to start confessing, it was all for naught as the governor in Florida signed Bundy's death warrant as people out in the public cheered, holding signs that read things such as "Fry Bundy, fry," and "Today is going to be a good day for Bundy to die." And I remember the day that Ted Bundy was executed. I don't remember it, you know, perfectly, but I remember hearing about it on the news and asking my mother who this Ted Bundy fellow was that was being executed, and her explaining it to me somewhat without getting into too many of the gory details. And that is the end of our coverage on the Ted Bundy case. He was found guilty of 3 murders. He has known to have killed scores of others. Ted Bundy, in the words of one law enforcement official, was a man who simply existed to kill. That was his only reason for living. And because he simply existed to kill, he took the lives of many, many innocent young women and shattered the lives of their friends and families for decades to come. I hope you have enjoyed my coverage of this case. Until next time, stay morbid.